Today is Friday, October 25th, 2024, and we're having Ambassador Chas Freeman with us to talk about what's going on in this world, on this planet. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And let's start with what's going on with the latest report on the conflict between Iran and Israel. New York Times reported that Iran is preparing to fight Israel in a big manner, but at the same time, they're trying to de-escalate the situation. On the other hand, earlier we had the Times reporting that due to these leaked documents, the Israeli forces are postponing their attack on Iran. How do you find it right now? We had Antony Blinken's visit to Israel. When you put all of these pictures together, is Israel going to attack Iran? What do we know about the situation?
Well, I think the New York Times, for once, has it right. That is to say, if you look at Iranian behavior, they have tried very hard to signal consistently that they don't want a war with Israel. They have been very restrained in the face of outrageous Israeli provocations, the assassination during the inauguration in Tehran, the murder of Nasrallah in Beirut, the war with Lebanon, the assassination previously of numerous Iranian nuclear scientists and political leaders, and so forth. So they've been very consistent in their restraint. But it's noteworthy that the April mock attack on Israel, which was intended only to send a signal, and did so. It sent a signal that Iran, if it was pressed, could strike targets in Israel. That was followed by an escalated response on October 1st. Also a message that Iran really could do serious damage to Israel if it was pressed to do that. And I think what we can conclude from this cycle of escalation is that Iran is now tired of sending messages, and it will respond with full force to an Israeli attack on it. The Israelis, for their part, appear to have developed quite an elaborate plan, which involves firing cruise missiles from somewhere over Western Iraq or Syria, Eastern Syria, and ballistic missiles, obviously from Israel, probably aiming at doing to Iran what they tried to do in Lebanon and in Gaza, that is to decapitate the leadership. There might be other targets, but that seems to be their thinking generally. And of course, it doesn't work. You know, just think for a moment. Hezbollah sent a message to Israel when it sent a drone to attack Netanyahu's house. Apparently broke the windows there, even though those are bulletproof. Just think for a moment, suppose they had succeeded. Suppose Netanyahu was in residence and the drone had in fact murdered him. Do you think Israel would be fundamentally changed? Would it collapse because its leader collapsed? No. And what we have seen in the Middle East is Israeli policies premised on the notion that if you attack and succeed in killing the leader, the followers will adopt the fetal position, crawl into their beds, and surrender. But this doesn't happen. Usually what happens is when you assassinate a leader, you get a more extremist leader in his place. That was the case with the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, who was a reasonable man, a man of the hotels, as Yahya Sinwar put it. Yahya Sinwar succeeded him. He was the mastermind of the October 7th breakout from Gaza, and not at any in any way as conciliatory as his predecessor. I think we're going to see a turn to greater and greater extremism by the enemies of Israel. And Israel, of course, has created a situation in which every state around it is hostile to it. Whether they have a relationship with it or not, they all hate Israel. This is not a sound strategy for securing the state of Israel, even if things weren't happening inside Israel, which are driving Israelis out of Israel away, driving immigration. And in this regard, I'll just mention, I was very struck to see a poll by Ma'ariv, which is a newspaper in Israel, which suggested about 60% of the settlers in northern Israel who were displaced by Hezbollah's support, limited support, but support for the Gazan Palestinians, don't want to go home. They don't trust their security there, even though Netanyahu has used their safety and their return as the pretext for launching a war to annex southern Lebanon. And we should not be in any doubt about what this is. It is a war of extermination of the Palestinians and a war designed to annex territory. It is not a defensive war at all.
Yeah. It's so amazing to know what's going on in Israel in terms of the public opinion. Recently, Israeli journalist Elior Levy is talking about that. I wonder where those who decided that Hezbollah was collapsing are. And I also ask, what happened to the document that revealed that Hezbollah no longer has any members? If this is the case for the public opinion in Israel as well, because the way that they're informing, the government is trying to convince them that we're going to win in the southern part of Lebanon. And is the reality hitting the public opinion in Israel, or is it's just about the elite in Israel? They know what's going on.
Well, I'm not sure. I think we're seeing evidence of delusions on the part of both the public and the political elite, in part because there's now a censorship regime in Israel. Israel historically had a very vigorous and honest, for the most part, press. It also had some major propaganda inclined press financed by American Jewish plutocrats. Israel Hayom being the main example of that. But Israeli journalists have historically been very effective in revealing the facts. Now they can no longer do so. So what we learned from Hezbollah reports, and I must say, Hezbollah has a reputation for speaking accurately about its own losses, as well as those of the Israelis in conflict, is that some 70 plus Israeli soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon. 600 or more have been severely wounded. There have been major equipment losses as well. So Hezbollah is by no means without members and by no means on the ropes. It is a decentralized army. It has combat experience in Syria. And like other most Muslim populations, Arab populations in West Asia, it has the ability to suffer. It is not dismayed by martyrdom. So Israel has picked a tough fight. Of course, it has all the technological advantages, and it also apparently has the support of the United States, despite the fact that Lebanese Americans are appalled by what is happening. I am living now in the state of New Hampshire, which has had a Lebanese governor, Sununu, and has many Lebanese inhabitants. And I see Lebanese flags now flying. I've never seen them before. So I think Israel is alienating yet another block of people abroad, because the Lebanese diaspora is enormous. Every country in Africa, every country in Latin America, or North America, France, other countries, all have Lebanese minorities. And I don't imagine that any of them are happy about what is happening, especially because Israel's not only attacking the UN peacekeepers, but it has managed to kill a number of members of the Lebanese army who have tried to stay out of this fight. This is not an easy war for Israel. I don't think most Israelis are aware of the losses they are taking and will take if they continue on this rampage. This is even before we get into what Iran might do in response to an Israeli attack.
We had two important visits on the part of the Biden administration, sending Antony Blinken to Israel and the U.S. envoy to Lebanon, Hochstein. He went there to, I don't know, to talk with them, intimidate them. You may have some sort of understanding on what was the mission, but how do you see the picture right now? What is the Biden administration trying to do? Are they trying to manage the situation? Are they trying to convince Lebanese people that the problem is Hezbollah? Let's separate you from Hezbollah, which we know what would be the end game. They want to take the southern part of Lebanon.
Well, what we're hearing is a lot of talk about the major opportunity that the death of Yahya Sinwar represents, which is a delusion. It represents no such thing. In fact, the Israeli army is back in northern Gaza, attempting to reconquer the very areas that it began this war by conquering. And in Lebanon, the idea of separating Hezbollah from Lebanese is very appealing, but it is not practical because Lebanon is now being attacked. Israel may say it's attacking Hezbollah, but it is attacking Lebanese, and the Lebanese also come together when this happens. So I think the administration, Biden administration, shares the false belief of the Israelis that if you kill a leader, the organization that he led will implode. But that is not what happens. And it has not happened in either Gaza or Lebanon. What has happened is impairment of the military capabilities of Hamas and of Hezbollah. So the administration is trying, on the one hand, to assist Israel in establishing its hegemony and dominance over both Gaza and Lebanon. Northern Lebanon would be left as a sort of satellite state of Israel if Israel had its way. And Mr. Hochstein is, of course, a dual national Israeli-American citizen, is a veteran of the Israeli Defense Forces, and it's pretty clear what side he is on. Mr. Blinken is similarly inclined, self-declared Zionist. He seems to be doing the same thing. I understand he was denied a meeting in Jordan because people recognize that he is not what the French call interlocuteur valable, a worthy interlocutor. His visit to Saudi Arabia, I think, was in vain. In the middle of all this, we have the absurdity of Israeli and American representatives, Bill Burns, the head of the CIA, and the head of Mossad, going to Doha in Qatar to meet with each other to exploit the opportunity they see in Sinwar's death. But this raises the question, who's going to speak for Hamas? And why should Hamas now accept what is on offer, which appears to be a greatly abbreviated version of the UN Security Council approved offer of a temporary ceasefare? Now the only thing on offer is a short ceasefare, no effort to build a peace. I don't think this is realistic at all. And it will leave the next administration, whoever that is, and it's now looking more and more like it might be Mr. Trump, it will leave the next administration with a situation in which Israel has managed to create permanent enemies that entirely surround it. This is not a wise move. And the reorganization of the Middle East that Mr. Netanyahu has engineered is not the one he wanted. It is the one in which Israel will be in constant peril, not secure. And it is one in which Israel will be challenged on every front internationally and ostracized by others. And it is one in which Israel, having erased all the laws of war and the norms of humanitarian behavior, will now find itself subject to exactly what it has done to others. There is an adage which goes back to ancient times in most religions, do not do unto others what you do not want them to do unto you. Of course, Christianity reversed that and asked us to behave toward others as we would like them to behave toward us. But very few people actually follow that precept in practice. We are now in a tit-for-tat situation between Israel and Iran. The war is costing Israel enormously. It has lost the war economically because its economy is contracting. Its startups have left. There are now 60,000 small business bankruptcies in Israel. The fact that those settlers in the north don't want to go back home anymore is an indication of the despair that they have about the future of the country and its security. Israel remains tremendously divided between multiple forces. The military and intelligence people do not agree with the prime minister and the fascist members of his cabinet. The ultra-Orthodox are upset about conscription, the army is fatigued, the foreign investment has dried up. This is not a good situation. And the idea that somehow everything will be wonderful if Israel attacks Iran and manages to drag the U.S. into such a war is frankly a pipe dream.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the Netanyahu administration was talking about with all these strange behaviors on their part, these attackings, was about the hostages, Israeli hostages. So far, with what they're doing right now, going to Lebanon, escalating with Iran, and killing civilians in Gaza, it doesn't seem that what they're doing is helping their hostages, just to release their hostages. The exact opposite is correct.
Well, that is
the case with this.
That is the point that the hostage families have been making. And in fact, the only significant recovery of hostages on any scale was the result of a negotiation with Hamas. But if you kill the people representing Hamas, first Ismail Haniyeh, and then Yahya Sinwar, and then you try to kill the next one, who can make a deal, even if the hostages are still alive? I think probably most of them have been killed by the Israelis themselves through their bombing campaign and their indiscriminate sniping at anything that moves in Gaza. It's been more than a year now. If Hamas has in fact been seriously disrupted, one of the consequences of that is an inability to provide food and shelter for the hostages. I share the distress of the hostage families at the approach Israel has taken, which is completely counterproductive. And it's very clear that Netanyahu has applied the so-called Hannibal Directive, by which no Israeli hostage should be left alive to be exploited in the negotiation with the Palestinians, to these hostages. He doesn't seem to have any interest at all in recovering them.
Antony Blinken, before leaving Israel, said that Israel is winning strategically and let's go find some sort of political solution. Let's calm down, find a negotiation, go after negotiations. But when it comes to the attitude of the Biden administration, the way that they're trying to send everything Netanyahu is asking for. And today we've learned that they're going to send a new air defense system, THAAD, to Israel. Do you think it's the manner that they're trying to bribe Netanyahu in order to convince him not to escalate the situation? Or is it possible for them, for this administration, to consider stop sending weapons to Israel in order to put pressure on them?
I think it is part of a bargaining process, trying to limit the prospects of the war with Iran. I don't think it will work because Mr. Netanyahu will take the signal in the opposite sense from what the Biden administration may intend. By putting THAAD units in Israel, the United States is enabling Israel to escalate against Iran. Because if they work, this is a protection against Iranian retribution. I don't think they will work, by the way. And I think they're very vulnerable to attack by drones and other localized weapon systems. And I don't think they're that effective at high altitude interception of ballistic missiles. And I know that Iran does seem to have other systems, including systems that do not go ballistic, but are hypersonic. And so I think this is a political gesture more than an effective military one, but it will have the effect of emboldening rather than subduing Netanyahu's ambitions. And what are those? Those are to emerge from this crisis as the hegemon in the Middle East, having eliminated all of Israel's most capable enemies, in the case of Syria by dismembering it, in the case of Iraq by having the United States destroy it, and in the case of Iran, he wants to change the regime. He has such a level of hubris that he believes he can eliminate Iran as a factor in the Middle East. Well, I don't think that will happen. And I don't think there is any possibility at all that the Gulf Arabs, even those that had normalized relations with Israel, will be able to sustain that normalization under circumstances in which an extermination of the Palestinians and the dislocation of huge numbers of Lebanese is taking place.
The other important news that came out is these Iranians are Saudi Arabia, they're talking about having a joint naval drills in the Red Sea. With that rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, right now they're talking about, nobody would have imagined this coming between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And today we've learned, Bloomberg reported that the United States is suggesting to Saudis that they're going to support them, they're going to defend them if Iran attacks them. Are they trying to help the Israeli position in the Middle East? Is that possible? The way that, because Netanyahu doesn't care about these Arab states. The United States is doing each and everything possible at its disposal to help Israel. But what's going on? What's your understanding of what's going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia right now?
Well, I think the rapprochement, which was brokered by a combination of Iraqi, Omani, and Chinese mediation over a period, is actually working. The reason it's working is because of Israeli behavior. The region is so dismayed by what it sees in Gaza and now in Lebanon that it is coming together in a coalition, not backing Israel but opposing it. I don't think we should make too much of an Israeli, Iranian Saudi exercise. This is symbolic more than anything else. The idea that the United States could defend Saudi Arabia against Iran assumes that Iran would react, would follow the laws of war, would not follow Israel's example. But Saudi oil facilities in the Manteca Turquia, the eastern province, are entirely vulnerable to Iranian attack. The Persian Gulf is not very wide, and Iran has the missiles and drones to do whatever it wants in Saudi Arabia. Of course, the Saudis have the capacity to retaliate, but who would gain from this? Nobody. So what Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and de facto chief executive of Saudi Arabia, if you will, wants is to establish an independent, powerful, influential Saudi Arabia. Those purposes are now best served by working with rather than against Iran. And like his former best friend, Mohammed bin Zayed, in the United Arab Emirates, he is a realist. He's not full of delusions. He may have a temper and be somewhat emotionally unstable, as we have seen with the murder of the journalist Khashoggi and the consulate in Istanbul, and with other behavior. But I think he is a practitioner of realpolitik. And he now sees a good relationship with Iran as supporting rather than opposing Saudi ambitions. So this is a big change. And I would add to it something I once mentioned before. And that is, for the first time in about a millennium, Israel has managed to unite Sunni and Shia against it. These differences in doctrine and practice within Islam have now been subordinated to common cause, namely saving Al-Aqsa and saving Muslims from extermination. What Israel is doing is uniting the world against it. I think if you look at the statements coming out of Kazan, you will see the evidence of this.
Yeah. You talk about Kazan and the BRIC summit in Kazan. We had China and India putting out that they came to a solution for the conflict they had at their border. What is the importance of this, Ambassador, considering the history between these two countries?
Well, it is a serious effort at reducing and controlling tensions. It is not a resolution of the border issue. That issue was essentially created by British imperialism. The British did a deal with people in Tibet who aspired to become independent from China. The Chinese central government never recognized that. When India became independent, the McMahon line, which the British had drawn on the maps without having done a survey to divide British India from Chinese Tibet, was redrawn by Nehru, the first prime minister of India, somewhat more into Chinese claimed territory. So India and China were bequeathed this disaster by British imperialism. In the 1950s, Zhou Enlai proposed to India that they just forget it, that China keep the disputed area in the west, which is the Aksai Chin, part of which is adjacent to Kashmir, which is divided between Pakistan and India, and China would give up its claims in the east to what is now an Indian state in the foothills of the Himalayas. It's very hard for democracies in India, especially then was a democracy. It has lost some of its democratic character, but it still has a functioning parliament and elections. It is very hard for democracies to make territorial compromises. And you can look all around the world and see this, even in Latin America. Autocrats can settle borders between themselves. This is the history of Europe, where countries like Poland and Ukraine and have been divided repeatedly. Germany was divided many times between great powers. These were not democrats doing this, they were kings. So it's very difficult for the Indians to address the Chinese offer, which remains on the table. The Chinese, I think, had always hoped to settle this through a negotiation. I think they've now realized that India is just not capable of that. So they're talking to the Indians about reducing and controlling, managing the tensions, rather than eliminating the cause of them, which is an undemarcated frontier. It's very significant because it comes in the context that you mentioned, that the United States was wooing India, seeking to enlist India as an ally against China. India is non-aligned and very hard to get. It does not respond well to efforts to cause it to align with anyone. It has not broken with Russia, despite American efforts to produce that rupture over the Ukraine issue. About 38% or so Indian arms imports are still from Russia. Its trade with Russia has boomed under the sanctions against Russia, where it has become a major buyer of Russian oil and refiner of it for resale in Europe. It has not declared its enmity to China. So what has just happened is a reduction in tensions, a detente, a relaxation of tensions, not an embrace, but a statement by India that it is not getting the sufficient benefit from the United States to cause it to give the cold shoulder to China, and it needs Chinese investment and Chinese technology. And to acquire this, it will have to relax some of the restrictions it put on its interactions with China. So this is India acting in a characteristically self-interested fashion. The Chinese, of course, don't want tensions with India because they have problems with the United States. They have a civil war they have not ended with the Republic of China, the former government, prior to the People's Republic of China, on Taiwan. So the two Chinese parties are drifting closer and closer to a resumption of fighting. These are not circumstances in which China wants to have a tense relationship with India. And in fact, there are some people who offer the conjecture, which is all it is, that Russians are happy with the Americans getting tied up in the Middle East. They will support Iran, but they're happy that the Americans have not been able to remove their forces from the region in order to focus on either them or China. The Chinese are shoring up their relations with potential enemies. If they start a war over Taiwan, or they feel they have to, they don't have to worry about India. They don't have to worry about Russia anymore. They don't want to worry about India. They don't want to worry about others. There's a certain logic here at the geopolitical level that doesn't seem to be greatly appreciated. But what happened with the Modi meeting with Xi Jinping in Kazan is, I think, very significant.
In the mainstream media, considering the BRICS summit in Kazan, they were one of the main questions in the mainstream media was that why is Putin not isolated when they saw all of these countries going to Russia? are they really pretending that they don't understand what's going on in Ukraine, or they're just blind about what's going on?
The media, largely the American media, which are a dominant factor in the world, have been peddling the story that Russia is isolated. Now, why? Because they define the world as the G7 or NATO plus Japan and South Korea. And by the way, it does look as though there are now North Korean troops training in Russia to go to the Ukrainian front. And there are many reasons they might be in Russia, but that seems now to be fairly well established. When Mr. Putin was asked the question, would they be sent to the Ukrainian front or to the area of Russia that Ukraine has invaded, Kursk, he appeared to confirm that that would be the case. And it is the case that South Koreans are now involved, apparently, in Romania against the Russians in Ukraine. And South Korean F-16s are either going to be given to the Ukrainians to be flown out of Romania, or maybe even flown by South Koreans. So we now have South and North Korea fighting proxy wars, which increases the tensions between them and the danger that they will get into trouble with each other on the Korean Peninsula. This is something that apparently China is very disturbed about, but nobody else seems to be, except the Americans, of course. We are using the presence of North Koreans for propaganda purposes. Kazan was significant for many reasons. And one of them was that, as I've said on many occasions, contrary to what our press has been reporting, Russia was never isolated. It was reoriented. It was reoriented away from Europe and the West, which it sought to join in an earlier period, toward China, India, the Middle East, West Asia, and Africa, and to some extent, Latin America as well. So it was never the case that Russia was isolated. It was simply redirected. And we saw that at Kazan.
Do you think that these countries, we've learned that Russia, China, at least Xi and Putin were talking about what's going on in Gaza, in Palestine. They want to find a solution. But how serious are they when they're talking about Gaza? And how important is the case of Gaza for them? We know that they know Iran is connected, directly connected to this conflict. And how, in your opinion, in their eyes, what's the importance of Gaza for their type of policy?
I think there are two major interests. One is that Gaza and the wider war that Netanyahu has sought to ignite following the October 7 breakout by Hamas and others from Gaza, could ignite a world war. It could go nuclear. I think Israeli threats against Iran, among other things, probably accelerated an Iranian nuclear program to build a bomb. There's more and more indication that that may be the case, despite the fact that for religious reasons, Khamenei and his predecessors have all ruled that out. I think they've come to the end of the line on that. So there's that interest. But there's also a general interest, which is what the BRICS meeting was expressing, to try to preserve rather than collaborate in the destruction of international norms, of the laws of war, of humane conventions, the Geneva Conventions, and so forth, for the same reason that I mentioned earlier. Namely, if you treat other people with restraint, you can hope they will treat you with restraint. Israel has abandoned all restraint. Iran has not yet. But there is a chance that we will all emerge from these events in West Asia with no fabric of international order and self-restraint left. And that is not anything that anybody who was present in Kazan would welcome.
Yeah. The other important issue in this subject, in this BRICS summit, was the Turkey being part of this summit. And they went there at the same time we had a terrorist attack in Turkey. And do you find any sort of relation between what has happened in Turkey and Turkey's presence at the BRICS summit, or it's something regional, not related to BRICS summit?
Well, I think the sources of Turkish dissatisfaction with the United States in particular, and NATO and the EU in general, are very well known. As I've remarked before, there is no country that I can think of where as many foreign policies of the United States or other great powers require the support of the local government. You simply can't conduct a successful policy toward Iran, toward Syria, toward Iraq, toward Greece, toward Cyprus, toward the Eastern Mediterranean, the Caucasus, the Black Sea, Russian Federation, the European Union, West Asia generally, Israel, Palestine, the Persian Gulf region, and or the members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation without Turkish acquiescence or support. So Turkey occupies a very central position in terms of global interests. I should have mentioned Central Asia as well. I think Turkey has been disrespected. And particularly the support of the United States in northern Syria of the PKK, the Communist Party of Turkey, which is a terrorist, an organization that depends on terrorism, and which has carried out numerous terrorist acts in Turkey, and which Turkey has blamed for this latest set of murders. This has worn U.S.-Turkish relations very thin. This comes in the context when the European Union, largely at French insistence, has identified itself with Christendom, a body of Christian countries, and does not want a Muslim country member of any size. It might accept Albania, but will not accept Turkey. So Turkey's 300-year effort to Europeanize itself has come to an end, just as Russia's has. And so you see both Turkey and Russia looking south, looking east, and no longer looking west. So yes, this is very much connected with what happened with the BRICS organization at Kazan, because that is a group that is not so much anti-Western as intended to separate themselves from the West. They want to do their own thing. There is a risk that they will become anti-Western, because the United States tends to treat them like a bloc. They are not a bloc, they are a forum, which is very different. They have no military alliance. There's no obligation by anybody to come to the aid of anybody else, but they are working out new institutions to manage new challenges in the global economy and politics.
And what she said in the BRICS summit is BRICS should act as defenders of collective security. And I think one of the key moments in his talk, what does he mean by this, in your opinion?
I think he's talking about exactly what I was mentioning a few moments ago, and that is preserving the rules of the order that was established after World War II, not the so-called rules-based order in which the United States and other G7 members make and impose the rules, but the rules that were established by global consensus and that protected everybody. This is collective security in the form of the United Nations and international law. It is not in collective security in the form of a military alliance like NATO. So I think this is what he's talking about. It's very consistent with his security initiatives and doesn't really represent anything very new. You know, China has been labeled by the United States, and it's almost an axiom in American political dialogue that China aspires to replace the United States as a global hegemon. I don't think there's any evidence of that. I think what China wants is a secure international environment in which it can grow to prosperity in tranquility. It is domestically focused. It is defensive. It is not focused on taking war or occupying countries far from its frontiers.
Whenever they're talking about the economy of BRICS, they're talking about the military powers within BRICS, they're talking about we are defensive forces. Do you think that would help the United States to decide not to go further, just considering these organizations as they are?
Well, I think what the BRICS has the potential to do, for example, is to combine military industries and develop more effective defense mechanisms. It could even, if it is associated, for example, with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it could even stage military exercises among those members who volunteer for that. But that is a far cry from a bloc or an alliance. So is the United States capable of dealing with it in a non-hostile, non-military basis? I don't see that. Because what the United States is trying to do is to hold on to global hegemony, global primacy, at nearly all costs. And that is exactly why Mr. Blinken's conference with Mr. Netanyahu is an American embrace of Israeli hegemony on a regional level, because that would, in the eyes of Mr. Blinken and the Biden administration, consolidate American hegemony in the Middle East, which has otherwise been lost. I think, you know, the BRICS grouping, which now has another 13 member states in line to join, partner countries, including Turkey, which you mentioned, including Cuba, which has been a thorn in the side of the United States, including Bolivia, which has similarly been at it, but not including Venezuela, apparently. I think this is a very significant effort to build an alternative rulemaking body. That is, by consensus among the members of BRICS, they can do various things. This is the case with de-dollarization. They appear to have reached some agreements in principle to be worked out by technocrats over the course of the coming month or so to advance the cause of trade settlement outside the dollar zone. So this will not eliminate the role of the dollar, but it will reduce it. And it will eventually make it impossible for the United States to enjoy the monopoly on financial power that we have enjoyed, and which enables us to impose our policies through sanctions on the entire world. So this is an effort to liberate the world from American hegemony. It's understandable that the United States doesn't want that and would resist it. But there is no military resolution of it. There is no military solution for the United States, which, however, seems to be unable to imagine any approach other than a military one. So I think we are operating on different premises and going in different directions.
Before wrapping up this session, How do you find the situation of Serbia? They want to be part of BRICS. It seems in their eyes it's impossible to be part of the European Union because they don't let them in. And on the other hand, it doesn't seem that the European Union together with the United States are happy with Serbia being part of BRICS.
Now, so Serbia has always been odd man out in Europe, very closely aligned religiously with Russia, reactive to Turkish control, anti-Islamic, very nationalistic. And it was a miracle, I think, that Josip Broz Tito was able to unite all of the southern Slavs in the Balkans in a single country, Yugoslavia. And it was tragic for them when that country broke up. It's an illustration of that democratization can lead to extreme violence, as it did in the case of Bosnia. That began with a German recognition of Croatian independence, the Slovene Declaration of Independence, a rebellion by Albanians in the south, the separation of Montenegro from Yugoslavia, and North Macedonia. So it is an area that is very deeply divided by history, by religion, and by international relationships. Serbia is very sympathetic to Russia. Europe is not. And so when you see Turkey joining the BRICS, that is a member of NATO joining the BRICS. That is very significant. Serbia is on its own. But I think the expectation in Europe would be that membership in the BRICS, like Serbia's intimate relationship with China, would establish a bridgehead in the Balkans for Russia, for China, strengthen that bridgehead to the detriment of European interests as Europeans currently define them.
Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, talking to you and learning from you.
Good questions, as always, Nima. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.